remarkable we're living in this moment in time. It's also remarkable, it's a point of contrast, that we're living in a moment in time where, you know, states like Florida are moving in the exact opposite direction. It was stated earlier this week, the governor of Florida wants to move without any permits or any consideration, no requirements whatsoever, none for training. Why should you be trained? Gun safety saves lives. More guns, more lives lost.
Governor Gavin Newsom at a press conference yesterday as he unveiled a concealed carry bill. It would ban guns in most public places, including schools, hospitals, churches, and public transportation. The bill is in response to the 6 mass shootings that happened in California last month, and also a Supreme Court decision last summer that said Americans have a constitutional right to carry guns in public. If California passes the bill, it will certainly be challenged in court. And joining us now is Alexei Kosev. He's a Capitol reporter at Cal Matters. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Okay, so schools, public parks, public transportation, churches, it seems like almost every public place. Where else would guns be banned?
Right. I mean, this is sort of a very sharp response, shall we say, to the Supreme Court decision from last year. Essentially, lawmakers in California are saying that if we can't set the rules that we want for who can have a gun, then we're going to try and push to the very limits of what might be allowed in terms of where you can take a gun. And so, as you said, it's a lot of different kinds of public places, government buildings, medical facilities, playgrounds, bars, stadiums, places where they argue that there are, particularly sensitive people like children, like, medical workers, or where there are huge risk factors like alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Well, so lawmakers tried to pass a similar bill last year and failed. And why did it fail last year? And how is this bill different?
So it was a pretty stunning development last year. I mean, it seemed like California was headed toward a response to the Supreme Court decision fairly quickly, as other states like New York did. But on the very last night of session, the bill failed by a single vote in the state assembly. It needed a two-thirds vote, which is unusual for bills, but this one had an urgency clause that would have allowed it to take effect immediately. And so as a result, there was no law, and they have brought back a pretty similar proposal this year. And they're trying to sort of ensure its passage by taking things a little bit more slowly, building consensus, and removing that urgency clause so that it requires just a simple majority, meaning it would be pretty likely to get the support needed in a state where the legislature is so overwhelmingly Democratic.
Right. But that would probably, if not definitely, invite a court challenge, especially given what the Supreme Court ruled last summer, which basically said that Americans have a constitutional right to carry guns in public and have concealed carry permits.
There's no question that this bill is pushing the limits of what the Supreme Court said is allowed. California is definitely trying to figure out how far it can go. And so there are probably pieces of this in particular that are going to invite a challenge, as you said. The expansive list of these sensitive gun-free zones is certainly going to invite a challenge. And there are also other elements of this bill. There are certain kind of permitting standards that would still be in place, including that they would raise the age for concealed carry permits from 18 to 21. And that's the same age to purchase a handgun in California. So the supporters argue they're just sort of creating a parity in the law. But we have seen that there has been some courts who've proved hostile to laws that raise the age for gun ownership or gun purchases. There's even a law that California passed that was thrown out in court last year in part because it raised the age to buy certain kinds of semi-automatic rifles to 21. So there's a lot of legal questions that are up in the air about this approach that California is taking.
Right. So it's not only the raising the age limit, as you say, but also stricter licensing protocols. So like sheriff's departments, which grant these concealed carry permits, usually they would have to have in-person interviews. Someone would have to have 3 character references. The agency granting the license would have to scour social media for the applicant and on and on. Could those be seen as too onerous?
I think we're in a whole new era, and things mm-hmm. that once might have been considered reasonable, there's a question mark around them now simply because the court has shown that it's willing to entirely reconsider what kinds of rules are allowed or not under the Second Amendment. And gun rights groups have made very clear that they are ready to challenge basically anything the state does, as well as a lot of the rules that are already in place, because they also want to keep pushing the limit and pushing while they have this court that, you know, is on their side, keep pushing to expand what the Second Amendment means and what it encompasses. So not just this law, but a lot of gun laws in California are probably likely to go to court in the coming years and be this source of continual fights. Already in New York, which did move very quickly last year to pass a follow-up concealed carry permit after it was overturned by the Supreme Court, their new law is already undergoing a legal challenge, and that fight is playing out now. So as we're seeing, it's just going to be a heightened kind of legal battle all over the country as everyone tries to figure out where the Supreme Court might be drawing lines for allowable gun control.
Alexei Kossoff is a Capitol reporter at Cal Matters. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
California finally unveiled its proposal for cutting water use from the drought-stricken Colorado River. The state says it's committed to cut its water use by about 9%. For months, the seven states that rely on the Colorado River have been debating how to cut their water use because the river is really at critically low levels. The dispute turned really bitter this week when all the other states released a plan that California rejected. They say California has senior water rights under a century-old legal compact. That's what California says. And that the states with junior rights should make the most cuts first. Here to talk about all this is Elizabeth Cobley, professor of environmental policy at the University of Nevada, Reno. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on today.
Great to have you. Okay, so explain this plan that California submitted. 9%, it says it can cut by the year 2026. How would that happen?
Yeah, sure thing. So California's proposal is really focused around making voluntary cuts, and it relies on their legal position on the river, like you mentioned. So California has the highest priority of the lower basin states, which also include Arizona and Nevada, and they also have the highest water use. And so under our system of water governance, which relies on this seniority, California is the most shielded from cuts. So California said that they would take voluntary cuts to the tune of 400,000 acre feet a year for the next 3 years. And they also suggested what level of cuts other states should take too, with the majority of those cuts being borne by Arizona, who has junior priority. One other thing I'll mention about California's plan is that it actually waits a little bit longer than its competing plan to start taking deeper cuts, which might signal that we're in for a good flow year this year with a lot of snow in the upper basin. Mm-hmm. But while this may reduce the risk of conflict among the states, it might also raise the risk of shortage, at least in the near term.
So California is arguing, look, Arizona, primarily, you have fewer water rights. You're the junior priority, as you mentioned. And so mm-hmm. how is California offering, what plan is it offering to Arizona for it to cut its own water? What does California want Arizona to do?
It's essentially asking them to cut water use and water deliveries to different levels, depending on the level of Lake Mead, which is the reservoir that all of the lower basin states depend on. So they laid out a system of how Arizona might take those cuts over time. And it's really just about proportionally dividing these cuts. I think what is useful for this situation is that all of the lower basin states know that cuts are going to be inevitable. It's really just how we distribute them among the states. And some of the states have a consensus and kind of a cooperative approach, and California is really relying on its legal rights on the system.
So is California just waiting for the federal government to weigh in, just looking at the legal rights?
You know, this is part of a longer process, and these importantly are just proposals. They're not official agreements or plans. And so throughout this process, the federal government will compare proposals, including the proposal made by California and the proposal made by the other six states, and potentially the options that the federal government also thinks might be useful too, as well as comments that have been submitted by other stakeholders in the basin. And the federal government says that they're committed to continue working with states over the coming months. And the goal is to develop a draft plan in the spring and then finalize something by August, which is when we make projections for next year's water usage. So I'm hoping that because we now have some proposals and some numbers down on the table, that we'll actually be able to continue negotiating over the next couple months and not just wait for the federal government to make a decision and then California to possibly litigate if that decision doesn't align with their legal status on the river.
Well, what is your take on California's position? Do you think that 9% is reasonable, or will they have to cut more?
I think that all of the states in the lower basin are going to have to make cuts. I think what is really a critical issue here is that our system was designed in a time where we had a totally different hydrology on the Colorado River, and we really over-allocated how much water is available. Now that we have climate change, that's further exacerbating this issue. So I think we need to take a hard look about whether these cuts that we're proposing in either of the plans are realistic and how that might also affect us going forward. Because one additional step in this process is that a lot of these policies are going to expire in 2026. So these proposals are just for emergency measures for the next 3 years. And we're also looking forward to the next two decades of governing the Colorado River. So this is really the first step in a much larger process of trying to assess how we can make everyone's water use more sustainable.
Right. And so that in that under that old regime, under the old plan of divvying up the water, evaporation wasn't really considered. And now it is. It's a major sticking point. And California is saying, well, you can't take that into consideration because that's not part of the how it was designed. And the other states are saying, well, the fact of the matter is that water is evaporating. So we need to. How are they going to resolve that?
That's a great question, and is really one of the hot button issues. In the six state proposal, the idea of accounting for evaporation losses, about 1.5 million acre feet of water in these losses, is really core. And the six states argued that these evaporation losses should be divided proportionally based on the amount and the location of water use, which means California takes the largest cut based on their position as the largest water user and also the lowest in the basin. They rely on all of that infrastructure to convey that water down. California, on the other hand, has suggested that evaporative losses should just be taken off the top of the total available water supply, which would mean the junior users are really bearing the brunt of that. And so how we distribute these evaporation cuts is really critical as well, and whether we decide to kind of subtract them from the total available volume or try to divide them up based on who uses the infrastructure is the question at hand. And it really relates to that old system of priority on the Colorado River.
But on the ground, it comes down to people versus plants, right? I mean, it comes down to water for people in Arizona or water for plants in California, in the Imperial Valley, right? Just to reduce it down to its basics.
Yeah, you know, the Western U.S. is a really critical center for food production, and there's a lot of agriculture in Arizona as well. And this region has very fertile soils, which is why we grow so much agriculture here. However, 80% of the water in the entire Colorado River Basin goes to agriculture. And in my opinion, we've done a much better job focusing on conservation in the municipal and industrial sectors, but that only gets us so far because they only use 20% of the water. So while there are benefits to growing agriculture in this region, we really need to be focusing on agricultural conservation, looking at which crops are highest value and most needed, and significantly bringing agricultural water use down in the future. We've almost done all we can in the municipal and industrial sector, or we're at least getting closer. There's always more to do. But the agricultural sector is really where the vast majority of this water is going and where we're really going to need to see some big conservation in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Elizabeth Cobley, Professor of Environmental Policy at the University of Nevada, Reno, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
how California is leading the way when it comes to passing new abortion protection laws. Other states are trying to emulate some of them. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The ink wasn't even dry on last summer's Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade when red states moved to outlaw abortion. California, though, did the exact opposite, protecting doctors, nurses, and midwives who perform the procedure and enacting other protections, even enshrining the right to an abortion in the state's constitution. As California goes, so goes the nation is a tired cliche, but in this case, that's what's happening with other blue states. Some are looking to California for inspiration for their own laws. Alice Miranda Olstein wrote about this for Politico, where she covers healthcare on Capitol Hill. Welcome back to Press Play, Alice.
Thank you so much.
Well, you recently came here and spent some time at UC Santa Barbara, where a new law, a new state law, requires state colleges and universities to keep the abortion-inducing drugs mifepristone and misoprostol on hand and available to students. Talk more about what this law says.
Absolutely. So, you know, when I was looking at all of the new abortion rights legislation California was implementing in January, some of which passed years before the Supreme Court decision, but some of which passed much more recently, but a lot went into effect in January, and they sort of fall into two buckets. One are the legal protections for both Californians and people coming from out of state for the procedure. And the other bucket are measures to try to make abortion more affordable, more accessible, more easy to obtain, you know, again, both for California residents and people from out of state, many, many of which have been coming to the state for the procedure since the Dobbs ruling. And so The new mandate that student health centers provide these abortion medications, that is part of sort of the second bucket, the making access easier bucket. And it's the first of its kind in the country, but we've seen since California passed it, Massachusetts has passed it, and now New York is looking to pass it, and other states are taking a look as well.
Right. And so in this particular instance, this law regarding state colleges and universities, you can just, as a student, just go to one of these student health centers and get these drugs?
Well, I mean, you can't get them over the counter. So you do have to get a prescription from someone at the health center, but you can be prescribed and given the drugs, and you can take the drugs at home, you know, wherever is most comfortable for you. And also under new California policy, folks who are not physicians, but who are, you know, nurse practitioners and midwives are able to dispense as well. In a lot of other states, it's just doctors.
But you don't have to go to your doctor first. You can just go to the health center and get it from someone there who's licensed.
Sure. And you know, a lot of students are on their school's health insurance, and so that is their regular doctor anyways. For others, that's not the case. And so it's interesting, another piece of this, that not all college campuses in the state are doing, but they are doing it at UC Santa Barbara, which is, you know, if someone is either uninsured or on their parents' insurance and they don't want this to show up, they don't want their parent to know about this, there's a pot of funding so students can be able to afford this out of pocket. And so not all campuses are doing that. But, you know, I went to UCSB because they were kind of at the vanguard. They got their program up and running well before the January deadline. And so they were able to sort of walk us through everything that entailed in this new era for California.
Interesting. Well, that's caught the eye of Republicans in Washington who have introduced a bill to strip federal funding from any college or university that does this. So could that supersede the California law?
So, you know, with Congress right now, you have a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. And so very little of anything is going to pass, and especially something like like this would never pass the Senate. And so it's an indication of what Republicans would like to do and maybe could do if they had, you know, more power in Washington.
Okay, so what are some of the other laws that California has recently implemented regarding abortion? How have they been replicated or are being attempted to be replicated in other states?
Yeah, so I think the most common ones are the legal protections for both providers and patients. So you saw Illinois move very recently to pass similar policies. You saw Minnesota very recently. It was just signed into law today, I believe, by the governor, approved some of the legal protections for abortion providers and patients. And again, you're seeing New York really take a hard look at some of these. And so, you know, we're in this era now where a lot of states were caught off guard by the ruling last summer and are now looking to see what they can do. But also, even a lot of states that were proactive, like California, they were proactive, but drafting laws aimed at concerns that you think might happen is different from really seeing this play out on the ground. And so California officials told me, you know, they're not done. They fully expect to, you know, revisit this issue and have to draft laws in response to things that other conservative states are doing that they may not have anticipated.
Yeah. And I think what's also interesting is the laws passed in California that protect workers who provide abortions to people coming from out of state. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine that that might set up an interstate showdown in court.
Sure. So, you know, California sort of is trying to set up this legal firewall, and it hasn't really been tested yet. And so, you know, it only takes one zealous prosecutor somewhere out in the country to try to test this question and test which state laws prevail, you know, the intersection between federal and state laws. And so we're really in this unknown territory where California and these other states that have followed in California's wake are trying to imagine every possible scenario, but they fully admit that that's not possible and that they'll, you know, we'll just have to see this play out in court eventually.
Right. And with California really aggressively marketing itself to patients in other states, putting up billboards in red states saying that they can come to California, and also setting up a website, right?
That's right. And so they were able to provide some new data from their website. And so they were able to show that most of the traffic in, and this, these are tens of thousands of unique visits to this website describing both the legal protections and the sort of affordability and access mechanisms for abortion. You know, the vast majority of the traffic to that website was coming from out of state. And so, yes, you know, California is, you know, not only preparing to receive the patients, the state is actively, I wouldn't say recruiting, but advertising and encouraging people to think of the state as an abortion haven, an abortion sanctuary. They've used these terms.
And are they putting up the money to back that? Are they helping out abortion providers financially to take on this influx from out of state?
That's the aim. So the state has allocated more than $200 million for that work. Most of that has not been dispensed yet. And so I talked to the state has multiple Planned Parenthood affiliates since it's such a big state. And they say, you know, they're keeping an eye on, you know, when that funding becomes available and whether it's, you know, dispensed in a fair way. And so they want to, you know, hold the state accountable to its promises. But theoretically, there are these pots of funding now to help pay for travel and lodging and other needs for people coming in from out of state, to reimburse doctors who are providing procedures to folks who can't afford to pay or don't have insurance that covers it. There's funding to help clinics hire more people and train them. So we in the media and, you know, the advocacy world certainly is keeping a sharp eye on whether it meets the needs.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Alice Miranda Olstein. She covers healthcare on Capitol Hill for Politico. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here with a treat you can make for your sweetie on not Thanksgiving Day, on Valentine's Day. Well, maybe also Thanksgiving Day. Later in the show, we'll have your weekend film reviews, including the latest horror flick from M. Night Shyamalan.
The opening scene is masterful, but the premise of that brilliant beginning is, you know, it's broken as quickly as couples break up on an episode of Love Island.
Those stories are coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
They say the way to anyone's heart is through their stomach. And with Valentine's Day right around the corner, well, you know what you got to do if you want to win a few hearts. You got to splurge on something delicious to eat. Evan Kleinman is host of KCRW's Good Food. She's got a great idea, and that idea is chocolate souffle. Chocolate souffle? Wow. Okay. I was thinking just a box of chocolates, but you've outdone me.
We've done a box of chocolates in the past, so I had to go farther afield.
You had to get creative. Okay. Yeah. So what do you like about a chocolate souffle?
The luxuriousness of the texture combined with the waiting time, I think, gives you this wonderful kind of flirtatious, special food moment.
Ooh, a flirtatious, special food moment. I love it. I know souffle does feel that way. It feels special. It feels, alas, transitory.
Yes, which I think is one of the greatest things about it, that, you know, the word souffle in French means breath.
Breath.
A breath is here, then it's gone, totally mm-hmm. evanescent. And a souffle, the minute you take it out of the oven, you have to put your spoon in because it will start to deflate, which, you know, lends
just
also.
Just like love.
Just like love. But it still is delicious.
It is always delicious, even the next day. Okay, so it's not lava cake, which is another delicious chocolate dessert to be eaten on Valentine's Day. It's kind of the opposite.
Lava cake is much denser, and it has an absolutely liquid center. The thing I really love about souffle is there's such a variety of textures in it, from the crispness of the top, the cakiness of the edges. And as you move towards the center, it becomes more moussey and foamy. And then depending upon how much you cook it and what your preferences are, it can be, you know, very soft, nearly liquid in the middle.
It sounds a little daunting to cook, I'll be honest.
It's actually a pretty easy thing to make. I mean, the worst thing that happens is that it'll just puff up a half an inch instead of 4 inches. It's still going to be really good.
Okay, so what are some of your tips and tricks that you've learned?
Have all of your ingredients at the temperature that the author of that recipe tells you to. Some people do it where they want your eggs to be absolutely at room temperature. Some people don't. You can actually make the base like a day in advance.
Oh.
And then take it out of the refrigerator and then just do your egg whites and fold your egg whites in. But one of the things I've done is I've linked to pastry chef and noted blogger David Leibovitz's article on his souffle tips. Like, one of the things he does is he beats his egg whites at a lower speed. He says it gives you smaller bubbles, which will allow you to have greater loft and more stable loft than if you beat the egg whites like crazy, where you get bigger bubbles.
So that's one idea. And you have some other videos that you've seen that you like?
Yeah, I really love, Claire Saffitz has actually done two. She did one years ago, I think, in like 2008 when she was part of the test kitchen at Bon Appetit. It's really sweet and fast. But she's more recently done one for the New York Times. And she goes really in depth. I think it's a really great video to watch because you can really clearly see what she's doing at every stage. Also, I link to a huge article with recipes by Melissa Clark that's part of their classic French series of things that you need to learn to get that real French kind of culinary education. Between those two things, I think you'll learn everything you need to know about making it.
Yeah. And not open the oven door when it's cooking, right?
That is a total myth.
What? You can open the oven door? Won't deflate the souffle?
Well, why would you? And first of all, most of our ovens...
Take a peek.
Well, most of our ovens have, you know, this marvel of modern technology, glass and a light. So you don't need to open it. But if you need to open it towards the end of the cooking, just to touch the ramekin a little bit to see if it jiggles, you can do that without any problem. And you don't need to tiptoe around the kitchen.
So it's not as sensitive as we think it is.
No, no. Which is really good because we're sensitive on our own. We don't need our desserts to be sensitive to.
Exactly. And do you serve your souffles in individual cute little ramekins?
I think if you're making them for the first time, making them in smaller ramekins is not a bad idea. But what will happen probably is you won't get a super lovely, kind of more soft center. I think that part of the beauty of making a souffle for somebody you care about is when you both dip your spoons into the same bowl at the same time. And also, I love the traditional way of service where you will spoon some out onto your own dish, and then you can decide how much sauce you're going to pour over it if, in fact, you're serving it with crème anglaise.
I guess you are serving it with crème anglaise, is what you're saying.
Well, I'm happy to not have any crème anglaise. I really don't like ice cream because I don't like how cold it is. And you have this beautiful hot souffle that you've slaved over. Why put something ice cold on it? Ice cream base is what crème anglaise is. So if you don't want to have to make it, just melt your ice cream and then heat it up a little bit. Warm it just a little bit.
What? Oh, you're blowing my mind. All right. So if we don't want to make it, where do we buy it?
I will shout out Wolfgang Puck because I think at nearly every Wolfgang Puck property, there is an absolutely delicious chocolate souffle. Certainly Spago is famed for it, as is the Polo Lounge. All these places, you should call ahead and make sure that they're making it.
On Valentine's Day.
You don't have to go on Valentine's Day. Make your life easier. Go a day before, a couple days after. Why deal with all that pressure? I have a whole list for everybody.
Oh, sounds great. Okay, that list will be on our Instagram at KCW Press Play. Evan, what is on Good Food this week?
I talked to Tanya Holland, who showcases modern soul food influenced by her family's migration from the South to California. And I also have this marvelously sweet conversation with Jacques Pepin, not about his time as a chef, but his time as a painter. He paints a lot of chickens, and he's published a book of his chicken paintings, just beyond adorable and sweet. You will want one.
I want one right now. I haven't even seen them. I want one so badly. Evan Kleiman is host of KCRW's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 10 and wherever else you get your podcasts. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Thursday, so you know what that means. The best time of the week, it is film review time. And here with us are Katie Walsh and Sean Edwards. Katie reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the Los Angeles Times, and The Wrap. And Sean is an award-winning film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with Knock at the Cabin. This is from M. Night Shyamalan, and this movie is about, the apocalypse, kind of. Here's a clip.
My name's Leonard. What's nice to meet you, Will?
suppose I'm here to make friends with you. And your dad's too. But my heart is broken.
Why is it broken?
Because of what I have to do today.
Okay, there's the knock at the cabin. Katie, what is this movie about?
Well, like you said, it is about the apocalypse, or at least the idea of the apocalypse. It is based on one of the most terrifying books I have ever read by Paul Tremblay. That book is called The Cabin at the End of the World. It was so scary, I didn't want to finish it because I didn't want to know what happened at the end. But I obviously did finish it for this movie. But it's interesting because it's really about people, and basically this group of people show up at this family's vacation rental, and they say that the apocalypse is happening, and the only way that they can stop it is if the family chooses one of their own to sacrifice. And so it's really about this psychological persuasion and what you choose to believe and what you don't choose to believe, and the ways that you get someone to believe you that the world is ending when you are so convinced of it yourself. I think it's really well made. The cinematography is amazing. I love the visual language that Knight and his cinematographers are using here, especially when you're in this confined space, because it's basically just in the cabin with seven people. I think it's a really well-made film. It's very good. It's extremely technically well executed, and the acting is just incredible from everyone in the cast.
Okay, so as scary as the book?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
Sean, what did you think?
This film is sort of a pseudo mystery horror film that really has no reason to exist. Now, you know, as mentioned before, it is superbly crafted and the acting is terrific, but it's not original. It's not scary. It's not thrilling. The opening scene is masterful, but the premise of that brilliant beginning is, you know, it's broken as quickly as couples break up on an episode of Love Island. And because it is adapted from a novel, I mean, it's not entirely M. Night's fault this time around, but the tension that happens sort of like breaks all the rules. And at the end of the day, this movie's really not worth seeing.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So that is a two thumbs down.
My thumb is sideways.
Well, Sean's two thumbs are way down. Yours is okay. You have a sideways thumb. Okay. All right. Knock at the Cabin, playing in wide release beginning tomorrow. Next up, 80 for Brady. It's a group of friends in their 80s who take a trip to the Super Bowl to see their hero, Tom Brady.
Aren't you tired of the same old boring lives? Let's go to the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl is no place for four old women.
This could be Tom's last one. He's almost 40. That's like 80 in people years.
Yeah, we're 80 in people years.
I just really need this trip.
Okay, so Sean, in the Department of Conspiracy Theories, Tom Brady announced his second retirement, or it was his second announcement of his retirement yesterday. He happens to be a producer for this movie, and he's in the movie. Is that on purpose, do you think, that this timing happened?
I don't know. The Tom Brady retirement sort of happens at the same time the movie's opening. Do with that what you will. This is basically not even a movie. It's basically like a highly stylized commercial for the NFL. And it says everything about the popularity of the National Football League in the past 20 years. And the fact that, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago, you know, watching professional football was deemed to be something that men did on Sundays, and they retreated to their men caves, and they watch football nonstop all day on Sunday. But in recent years, the popularity of the NFL has tremendously increased with women. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of like completely speaks to that. But, you know, as a film, 80 for Brady is essentially Girls Trip for women of a certain age. And it also has those, if you can remember the movie, it also has very 9 to 5 vibes to it that instantly makes this generic comedy nostalgic. And it's,
yeah, because, you know, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are in it.
Exactly. And it works. And they're amazing. They just didn't have much to work with. And what little they had to work with, they make this sort of a fun, charming sort of watch. I mean, it's very light fodder. So there's really nothing here to think about. And there's really nothing here to condemn.
Okay. Katie, what did you think?
I don't watch football. And to be honest, I don't even think this takes place at the 2017 Super Bowl. I was on the edge of my seat because I don't even think I watched that Super Bowl. I was like, who's going to win? But I'm not a football fan. So there you go. But I was highly skeptical of 80 for Brady. The trailer had me really nervous. The billboards had me really nervous. And I was pleasantly surprised, I have to admit. It was better than I thought. I had fun with it. And they do explain why Jane Fonda is wearing such a terrible wig. So that was all I needed. And I had fun.
Maybe when Brady is 80, he'll do a movie like this.
Yes. Brady is 80. That's the sequel.
All right. 80 for Brady, playing in wide release beginning tomorrow. Moving on to The Amazing Maurice. This is a British animated feature about a cat who is a swindler and a crew of talking rats. Here's a clip.
The original fairy tales are all the same. The princess, the hero. But this story is all about
me. Meow.
Our next target is this way.
Okay.
Well, have you noticed? There's no food.
That is odd for a market town.
All right. So, Katie, this movie describes itself as not your average fairy tale. What's happening here?
Right. So this is based on the book by Terry Pratchett, The Amazing Maurice and His Educated Rodents. And it's kind of this, you know, Maurice is voiced by Hugh Laurie. He is this con artist, sort of snake oil salesman cat who takes his rats around to different villages. He tells all the villagers, oh, you have a plague coming. And then his Pied Piper, who is voiced by Himesh Patel, comes in, and all the villagers are so glad that the Pied Piper has taken these trained rats out of the village that they give them lots of money. But the rats are sort of opposed to it. They're not natural con artists, and they're questioning what they're doing. It's also quite meta. Emilia Clarke voices a character named Militia, who is sort of commenting on the narrative and saying, reading a framing device, but then she's also a character in the story. So I thought this was okay, but I'm sure kids will enjoy it. And it's got a great voice cast, and it's based on this very beloved book. So,
okay.
Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah. Sean, what'd you think?
It's fun. It's charming, and it's perfectly silly. I mean, you know, no, it's not going to win any awards in the animation department. It's very simple. It's not groundbreaking, but I like the humor, and I like the sort of like manic storytelling. But the thing that I'm worried about is I'm not sure that any of this will actually connect with young children, because I found the humor to skew very much adult. Like, all the jokes were funny to me, but it worked just fine. I'm just not sure who it's for.
Okay, The Amazing Maurice, playing in limited release beginning Friday. Last up, Pamela, A Love Story. It's a documentary about Pamela Anderson's life, from her Playboy days to her Baywatch days to the infamous stolen sex tape that recently was the subject of a Hulu miniseries.
I didn't sleep last night at all. If anybody's watching this, go to hell. I blocked that stolen tape out of my life in order to survive. And now that it's all coming up again, I feel sick. I want to take control of the narrative for the first time. Dear,
I
feel we're
facing a problem. I don't think people consider her the owner of her own image. It's Pamela Anderson, public property.
All right, Sean. So it seems like this movie is definitely told from the perspective of Pamela Anderson. Tell us more.
No, it's definitely told from her perspective. First off, I think that the title's a little misleading. It's called Pamela, A Love Story. It should actually be titled Pamela, A Very Complicated Story. Basically just sort of like retelling her story and you know, how she got started, some of the things that, that happened in her life. And it's a very heartbreaking story. And it's also pretty much what you would expect to hear from a pre-Me Too celebrity who rose to fame, you know, in the 90s. It was produced by her eldest son, so you can't help but feel sort of the one-sidedness of everything, which to me sort of reduces the authenticity of everything that mm-hmm. she's saying. So it's not that I don't believe her, but it would have been nice to sort of like get both sides and also get a bit more, you know, detail, especially about her time she spent, you know, shooting for Playboy and spending time in the Playboy mansion and working on Baywatch, because she makes interesting comments like, you know, I went to go buy something and use my credit card and I was worried if the charge would go through. And you're like, huh, what? Please explain. You were one of the most known people on the planet and you started in Baywatch. How are you having these, you know, financial issues? And they, you know, they really don't talk about like the mechanics of the tape. And, you know, in actuality, I think she left a lot on the table, but you know, if you're a fan, she gives you enough and you feel sympathetic for her. But I think there's a lot more to the story that could have been told.
Katie, what did you think?
I mean, I think it's kind of problematic to say you don't really believe her in this story, because it's like basically the only time that Pamela like has been able to tell. I know, but you kind of indicated that. And so I'm just saying, I think that's like kind of a heavy thing to say when this is the first time that this woman who has been completely victimized by not only her ex-husbands, but the media, the tabloids, she had her, you know, sex tape put out without her consent, and she was horrifically treated by the legal teams that basically slut-shamed her for being in Playboy and said she did not own her own image because she had already been in Playboy. So this is like a really important corrective to the record. And I did watch Pam and Tommy. I think that that show was well made. And I, in a way, I sort of feel bad for watching it now because she hated it so much. But I think that that show really dived into the media landscape, the way that the tape was received, and sort of the technological aspects of it, the way it went from a VHS tape that was being sold, you know, via mail order to being on the internet, and how it was like a huge technological advancement in that way. And then this is truly Pamela, a love story. It is about her love stories that she has had with all of her ex-husbands and the way that she talks about being a hopeless romantic who falls in love, loves falling in love, and has kind of dedicated her life to all of these relationships with men that have not worked out. And at the end of the film, you realize that like this is Pamela's love story with herself, and that she's taking mm-hmm. the time to really learn how to be alone and to like do everything that she wants to do just for her. So I think this is a really important, you know, film to have out there that is her telling her story in a very unvarnished way, because everybody else has been telling her story for her. So this is the story that she wanted to tell. And I think it's really moving.
Hmm. But I guess she has been telling her story, though, in interviews along the way, right? I mean, she hasn't been silent necessarily.
No, I know. But, you know, it's always through the lens of like someone else's mm-hmm. Point of view. And she, in a lot of ways, one of the things I thought was really interesting is that in order for her to survive after the sex tape came out, because she was not taken seriously as an actress, she had to play into that role of sort of the dumb bimbo, the sex icon, the sex object. And, you know, that was the way that she had to, you know, she goes on Jimmy Kimmel, she goes on Jay Leno, like these people are making jokes about it. She has to kind of like play along in order to simply get through it. And then it's also interesting because she was not able to really act after the sex tape, that she had to lean into doing activism, like for PETA and using her sex image for that. And so it's like interesting to see the ways in which she had to pivot in her career. And I'm not actually that surprised that she didn't have any money after the legal battles and, you know, raising kids on her own and literally having her career destroyed by the sex tape. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Cool. Okay. Pamela, A Love Story, streaming now on Netflix. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the Los Angeles Times, and The Wrap. Sean Edwards is an award-winning film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend.